Your Steve Jones Show podcast will start shortly. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Brewers Outlet, your beverage supermarket on Reagan Street in Sunbury. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors Ford Lincoln Hyundai, North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury. Sunbury Motors Kia on the strip, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. And Sean Carey here as we wrap up Best of Week. And of course, Fridays around here brought to you by Brewers Outlet, the beverage supermarket, Reagan Street in Sunbury. That is the place to be this weekend. Mandatory Brewers Outlet pit stop. Heat waves starting. So we got to start to hydrate. Great specials going on through Tuesday. Miller's Light 24-pack cans. Get that Miller Light 24-pack cans are $12.95. Labatt 24-pack 16-ounce cans $17.97. And Seagram's 12-pack cans are only $10.99. And, of course, they've got soda, water, ice, lots and lots of ice right by the register. And your snacks, too. Chips, pretzels, fresh roasted peanuts, and you got to get to the pickle bar. So get to Brewers Outlet for everything you need for the perfect 4th of July in Sunbury. Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street, Sunbury. Congratulations to Corey and the whole crew on their 50th anniversary. And cheers to 50 more. We invite you to subscribe to our Steve Jones Show podcast, available on both Apple Podcast app, iTunes, and Google Play. You can also find 3 months of shows always archived at stevejonesshow.com. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, our Twitter handle at stevejonespsu. Well, today is the first day in over 2 weeks. No soccer World Cup taking the day off today, but the Group of 16 begins tomorrow. So tomorrow through Tuesday, there will be two matches a day. All right, coming up tomorrow, you got France-Argentina, Uruguay-Portugal, and then on Sunday, Spain versus Russia, Croatia versus Denmark. Monday matchups, Brazil-Mexico. That's a must-watch. Belgium-Japan, and then the final two games in the group of 16 on Tuesday will be Sweden-Switzerland and England will be taking on Colombia. Winners of all those games will go to the matchups next weekend on Friday and Saturday, the 6th and 7th. Steve will be back on Monday. We'll get new shows back in. And tonight, of course, we'll have Phillies baseball on WKOK, 6:30, airtime for On Deck. And then first pitch at 7:05, game number 2 of the 4-game set between the Phillies and the Washington Nationals. And great performance last night for Aaron Nola. Back-to-back nights, the Phillies getting great starting pitching. Aaron Nola last night going 7 2/3 innings, giving up only 1 run, 5 hits, 8 strikeouts, and 2 walks. He has 10 wins before the month of July, very rare for a Philly. Rhys Hoskins, second straight night with a home run. And Sir Anthony Dominguez had to come in the 9th inning to get a couple of strikeouts to lock up that save for Philly. So the Phillies are still in second place. They are now 2 games out of first. They were able to gain a half a game last night on the Braves. They had the night off. So the Phillies are 2 games away from Atlanta, and they are 2 games ahead of the Nationals in the NL East after that 4-3 win last night. So 7:05 will be the airtime this evening with Scott Fransky and Larry Anderson. Airtime tomorrow will be 5:30 for On Deck, 6:05 first pitch. And then the wrap-up of the 4-game set on Sunday. On Deck will be up and running at 1, first pitch at 1:35, all here on 1070 AM. So last hour, we replayed Steve's thoughts on the Rice Commission and how big of an effect it'll be on the future of college basketball. And after that, we had a chance to get in contact with one of the great masterminds of college basketball, has written about it for decades, not just college basketball, but also spent a lot of time in PA, grew up in Western PA, member of the United States Basketball Writers Hall of Fame from Sporting News and Big Ten Network, our great friend of the show, Mike DeCourcy.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
I'm doing well. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing great.
Great. The Rice Commission came out last week on Wednesday with their vision of what they think can help improve the game of college basketball. In your opinion, how well did they do?
In my opinion, if the opposing side were a basketball team, the college basketball commission on college basketball was beaten about 120-62.
Yep.
It was an absolutely embarrassing performance by all people involved. It was so intellectually dishonest, it was staggering. They came up with some decent ideas. There are a handful of decent ideas relative to the structure of college sports, like adding outside voices to the board of directors. That's a fine idea. I got no problem with that.
Yep.
But in terms of, quote, fixing college basketball, I mean, they didn't even give you a Band-Aid. I mean, if you have an open, bleeding wound on the game, they didn't even give you a Band-Aid. They just, they came up with solutions that don't solve any problems that they can't implement, and they came up with one solution, the suggestion that the NCAA in the future create their own evaluation venues, camps, tournaments, whatever you want to call them,
right.
That they create their own evaluation venues, and they're going to get sued so profoundly if they actually implement those that may actually be the thing that ultimately finishes the organization. I mean, I stood there about 6.5 hours after Dr. Rice did the presentation, reading what was essentially an executive summary of their report, mm-hmm. To a live stream and to an audience that included people in the media. About 6.5 hours later, two NCAA presidents and Mark Emmert, two presidents of NCAA member institutions who are members of high-level functioning bodies in the NCAA came in along with Mark Emmert, the president of the NCAA, and said that they voted to adopt everything. And I raised my hand and I said, "Do you realize that if you implement the takeover of the evaluation period, how vast that job is, how likely it is to get you sued?"
Mm-hmm.
And they just basically said, I can't remember exactly how they responded, but I think they feel like that. They're willing to take that on because the alternative was to actually look at it and say that the commission did a terrible job.
Okay, so I put, by the way, I don't disagree with anything you said. The next part is, if I were to sit you down in the room with them, and they said, "Mike, give me 2-3 things as somebody who's covered the game for decades and has been around it for decades that would be important on your list."
Well, I think that the first thing you have to do is you have to say that you lost the war on agents and that you have to allow them to make agreements, which I think they are saying that their language on that was highly nebulous, but I think that they're saying that it's okay.
Right.
But then you can't keep money out of the equation, because if you're allowing a young person to enter in some sort of agreement with an agent, but don't allow them to accept any money from the agent, either in terms of a grant or a loan, then the agent at that point has very little value. Perhaps for the player, if indeed the age limit were to go away, the player who is evaluating whether or not turning professional out of high school is a wise idea, the advice of an agent in that circumstance couldn't hurt.
Right.
But other than that, there's no value to a high school player having an agent unless that's a vehicle for the high school player, high school age player, to get some money that he and his family may need.
Well, hockey and baseball already have, it's not termed agents, but they're termed advisors. Hockey and baseball already have that, for example. So it's not a foreign concept for college sports.
Yeah, I think that the difference in those sports is that you have for both, you have a much greater, a much wider pool of athletes who have a more significant decision to make in terms of whether to turn professional or not.
Right.
The baseball player can come out of high school and reasonably, you know, enter the professional world with at least some hope of making it to the pros.
Which I see here all the time. Nick Kingham, first 20 batters for the Pirates yesterday, started his pro career here in State College.
Yes. I didn't realize he was a local for you guys. He did a great job yesterday.
No, yeah, not a local, but he played for the Spikes, the minor league team.
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah. And so that happens. In hockey, it's the same. And in hockey, probably has the best system of everybody. Because in hockey, they just draft whoever they want. And then if the player says, you know, I'm not really ready to play in your league, so I'm going to go play in college. They can do that, and they can play in college as long as they want. I mean, there's a player playing for the Bruins who's a member of their roster now in the Eastern Conference semifinals, who was enrolled at Harvard. He's technically still enrolled at Harvard.
Yes.
He's going to graduate in a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think they have by far the best system, and I wish they'd come out of that room and said, hey, NBA, here's an idea. Do this.
Right.
But they didn't. They didn't think of that. No, and I'll tell you why they didn't think of that. Honestly, they didn't talk to anybody. I mean, they didn't. I mean, I'm not saying they talked to anybody, but they didn't talk to anybody. I mean, I went to here in Indianapolis. There are a couple of summer event, off-season events, AAU events, whatever you want to call them, over the weekend. Really big deal events. Nike ZYBL.
Right.
Under Armour's association were here in Indy. So I went and I talked to every recruiting analyst that was there, and I asked them, did they talk to you? Did they bring you in? And I talked to probably a half dozen, and they all said no. Well, I'm going to tell you right now, Steve, that the very first people that I would have brought into that room after the NBA people was the recruiting analysts, because they know more than everybody.
Right.
They know everything that's going on. They know the whole deal, and they didn't even talk to them.
They're connected. You and I both know they're connected.
Yeah, I mean, you know, whether or not you believe that, you know, Brian Snow or Evan Daniels or Eric Bossy or whoever, whether you like their talent evaluation or not, or Paul Biancardi, you know, you may think that this guy gets it right more often than that guy. I think they all do a really good job, but they all know what's happening.
Sure.
And they could have gone in there and they could have laid it out. You know, I chuckled when the newspaper in Portland last month did this big expose or whatever you want to call it on summer basketball. Man, you could have lunch with Snow or Daniels and you could get this in half an hour.
Right.
And because those guys know what's going on. And the fact that the commission didn't bring them in is ridiculous. And there were many other people that they should have talked to and didn't. And I think it's because they don't you don't want to talk to people when you don't want to, when you don't want to hear the answers. It's like a lawyer never asks a question that he or she does not already know the answer to. I mean, that's kind of what this was. They went after the answers that they wanted.
Right. Well, exactly. It seemed like it was crafted ahead of time, and they were able to get whatever they wanted to meet what they wanted to do. Which now brings me to you and I both know there are only 60 spots in the NBA draft. There are, 181 early entries on the college level. There are more, obviously, from overseas. So you're guaranteed at minimum 121 are not going to get drafted. The part about letting undrafted go back, my opinion didn't go far enough. I think that if you don't like where you get drafted, you should be allowed to go back.
Well, you know, I agree with that. I mean, although it doesn't do you any good because the NBA has said that they're not going to redraft you, that you're going to have to stick with your original, your draft position doesn't die until a year after you become a professional.
Yeah.
Not much value to re-entering re-entering college basketball.
Right. Larry Bird did that. His rights were with the Celtics for 364 days, and about a week to 10 days before the next draft, he signed. He was the fifth overall pick in the previous year.
Yeah, so, but I remember about the 183 or 181 or whatever it is, a lot of them are going back with that. They're going to withdraw. It doesn't hurt you. It doesn't cost you anything to be in the draft. Now, there are, I think, 60-plus, low 60s, that have signed or committed to agents and basically said they're done.
Right.
That's up to them. I mean, I don't think it's smart for all of them. I think there are people who are making mistakes on that list. But you know, again, if they could have agents and accept money from agents, I don't know that you'd see that list be that long.
No,
because
I agree.
A lot of that is guys getting coerced by agents. Let me tell you a little funny. Do I have a second to tell you a funny story?
You have plenty of time, Mike.
Okay, great. All right. So there's a coach I know who has a player who is on that 180 person list, and he's decided at this point that he's not going to sign with an agent. And his coach is trying to get him not to commit to an agent until he's committed to the draft, because he doesn't believe there's any value in it for him. And he said to him, what are all the agents that are calling you every day telling you? That they can get you into Chicago, right? And he said, yeah, that's what they're saying. And he said, well, don't worry about it because I got you into Chicago. And the player said, gee, thanks, coach. I appreciate that. And the coach said, how gullible are you? I didn't get you into Chicago. Your play got you into Chicago.
Right.
I mean, that's the point. The point he made was that, you know, that's what you're dealing with. All these agents telling these guys that they can help them. The agents who can really help you, first of all, a lot of them are willing to wait. They're willing to wait to get you. So you don't have to be committed to them. The only reason for a player who's in the draft at this point to have an agent is if he's a defined lottery pick and knows he's going and probably is about ready to skip out of college and become a full-time draft aspirant. Maybe he'll take some correspondence courses to finish his degree or whatever, or finish his semester or whatever, but he's probably, headed somewhere to work out. But for the player who's on the fence, sure, there's no reason to have an agent at this point,
isn't.
And that's where that whole money thing comes in.
Right. I mean, there is no reason, because there's a point where, say, for example, you do well in Chicago. And by the way, getting into Chicago is not quite as easy as people think it is, but you're right. The NBA knows who they want to look at.
Absolutely.
I mean, they know, all right? So that's why when you mentioned his play gun, I mean, yeah. And that's why some of these guys get bad advice and suddenly are finding themselves today sitting back saying, what do you mean, I didn't get an invite to Chicago? That's what's happening. And the next part to me is, okay, you do well in Chicago. All right, I'm committed to the draft. Now hire an agent.
Yeah, I mean, and then at that point, they can navigate the workout process for you. They can make sure you're working out against the people that are going to benefit you. And, there may be a player that that doesn't suit if you're projected as a top 15 pick or a top 20 pick, and there's a third number 35 guy or number 50 guy that's going to come in and try to make a rep off you, no, you don't do that. I mean, you compete against the other top 15 guys because it may cost you a spot or two, but it's not going to cost you 20. And that's how an agent can really help you at that point. But going through Chicago as a draft aspirant, at that point you don't really need to have an agent to get a good idea of what you can do, of what you'll need to do, and then whether or not you should stay in the draft.
Because when I looked at the five primary topics that they put out, well, two of the five, they have nothing to do with. One dealt with,
right,
as you mentioned, the shoe companies. The other one was the one and done in the NBA, which, of course, was the headline everywhere. I'm saying they have nothing to do with that. That's an NBA rule, and you and I both know that the earliest they're even going to consider that is 2 years. That's the earliest.
Yeah, and, I mean, at the end of the day, Steve, it's so disingenuous for them to even bring it up. And it was the first thing, almost,
yes,
literally,
exactly,
that Condoleezza Rice mentioned. It's intellectually dishonest. I mean, here in Indiana, they have a lot of build the wall commercials on the air, it struck me this morning when I saw another one. I'm like, that's what one and done is for these people. One and done is an issue that you use to distract from the real issues.
Yeah,
it's everything about it is is intellectually dishonest. There's they said that you know, that these are clear targets for the agents. Yeah, but okay, that's true. But you think that they can't? That nobody in the NBA sees a guy pop up averaging 20 a game in college and doesn't then start blowing up the guy's phone?
Of course.
I mean, it's ridiculous. The fact that they make the fuss that they did. And I was listening to a podcast, an NCAA podcast that Jack Ford does with the athletic director at Miami Hurricanes, yep, who's on one of their key boards, and who was saying that, no, he said, well, you have to have something for players, that, and there hasn't been anything for players who don't want to go to the NBA but want to be professional. And I'm like, does he even have the internet? I mean, Darius basically 3 weeks ago said he's going to the G League.
Right.
Emmanuel Mudiay played in China.
Yep.
Terrence Ferguson played in Australia. Brandon Jennings played in Italy.
That's all right.
There's four guys. Right now you've got Mitchell Robinson, who didn't play anywhere this past year, yeah, just trained. He's gonna be in the draft this year. And Thon Maker just got eliminated from the playoffs. He played in prep school.
Yeah.
There's five different options,
right,
for the player who doesn't want to play in college but wants to be a pro.
Right.
And yet they act as if none of that ever happened.
Right, exactly. We just watched Maker with the Bucks over the weekend. What the heck? I was watching him play. And what struck me was that ended up being the headline everywhere. That was the headline.
Yeah.
Everywhere there was a thing.
She made it the headline. It was the first thing she said.
Exactly. And that part made no sense, because that is between Michelle Roberts and Adam Silver to hammer that out when they negotiate. And you and I both know that the NBA does not want to scout high school games. They want to scout college games.
I will say right now that if Adam Silver does go along with that, then he is not acting in the best interest of his league, in my opinion. Is not act because the one and done rule has been a spectacular success for the NBA.
No doubt.
It has trained a great level of players. Anthony Davis, Derrick Rose, Kevin Durant. It's been great for them. And if they choose to eliminate that rule and go back to drafting high school players, it is not in the best interest of the NBA.
No, and that's what strikes me about it, is that it is not, because you and I both know the owners wouldn't mind 2 years and 20. A little bit more mature league does not hurt their cause at all.
No.
In any way, shape, or form. So from the league point of view, from Adam Silver's point of view, I agree that again, they don't want to be scouting high school. Hey, let's go to Lower Merion High School in Philly and watch this kid. Really?
Yeah, but I mean, when Adam took over, he was saying that he preferred 20, and now he seems to be amenable to just giving up.
Yeah.
And I don't understand what changed. Everything about the rule has benefited the league. The scouts in the league, I talked to a bunch of them for a piece that I did in February.
Yes,
that you can
that.
Find online.
Yep.
Now I called it Stern Warning.
Yep.
And I talked to a bunch of scouts, and they all said that they much prefer to be evaluating players in college competition. They know what high school basketball is like, or what even AAU basketball doesn't tell you what will happen when the player steps up and plays in front of those kinds of crowds under that kind of pressure.
You and I both know that it's instead of scouting single-A baseball, it's like scouting triple-A. I mean, come on.
Exactly.
And that's what it is.
Exactly.
I mean, you're going to get a better read watching a Duke North Carolina game on the prospect as to what he can and can't do because of the competition.
Exactly. And that's, that's something that the people who are, who are trained as evaluators understand. And, I give you a great stat that shows you the value of one and done. And it's not, not everything that's happened is because of one and done, but while the one-and-done rule has been in place, the New York Knicks have gone from being worth $590 million to worth $3.3 billion.
That's right.
So why would you do anything to upset the apparatus that built that level of that escalated the value that rapidly? I mean, that's, to me, there's no reason for Adam Silver to go along with that.
Yeah,
I would say thanks, guys, but we like this a lot, and if you don't like it, that's fine. And for the Rice Commission then to say, if you guys don't listen to us, we're going to come back and we're going to make players ineligible as freshmen. I mean, how nonsensical was that?
I know.
I mean, so in order to chase out to chase out 8 players or 10 players a year, you're going to make literally 1,500 ineligible for competition. And so where are you going to get your how are you going to field a team? At that point, you'd have to expand scholarships because otherwise you wouldn't have enough guys to play.
Totally agree. Mike, I really enjoyed this. Thanks so much. Loved it.
Oh, it was great, Steve. Always a pleasure.
Celebrate America with America's Best Value Summer Event at Sunbury Motors Kia.
I wanna see you in a Kia. Sunbury Motors Kia.
As summer heats up, so do the special offers at Sunbury Motors Kia. The best season of the year deserves America's best value. And there's no better value than 20 new 2018 Kias for under 20 grand. You heard right. Sunbury Motors Kia has 20 new 2018 Kia Rios, Optimus Souls, and Fortes for under 20 grand. But that's not all. Get 0% financing for 66 months on most 2018 Kia models. Plus, all include the industry-leading 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain warranty. Celebrate America with America's Best Value Summer Event at Sunbury Motors Kia. Routes 11 to 15 in Hummel's Wharf and online at sunburymotorskia.com.
Offer expires 6/30/18. Financing offers exclude Kia Stinger, Cadenza, and Rio and are for qualified buyers through K&F Financing. Warranty is limited powertrain warranty. For details, see retailer or go to kia.com.
Party time, game time, or just fun time. Doesn't matter what time it is, because it's Brewers Outlet time. The Beverage Supermarket has the area's largest beer selection. Imports, microbrews, ciders, and domestics. Pick from over 100 ice-cold 12-packs and dozens of 24-ounce singles. Soda, snacks, hot sauces, fresh roasted peanuts. Make it one-stop party shopping, and don't forget the pickle bar. So whatever you're celebrating or just doing it up, Brewers Outlet, Reagan Street, Sunbury, wants to see you. And thank you for your years of patronage.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, Ford, Lincoln, Hyundai, North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury, Sunbury Motors Kia on the strip, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Best of Show Friday edition brought to you by Brewers Outlet, the Beverage Supermarket, Reagan Street in Sunbury. It is mandatory you get there. Fuel up, get your cold beverages for the heat wave. Miller Lite 24-pack cans, $12.95. Labatt 24-pack 16-ounce cans, $17.97. Seagram's 12-pack cans, $10.99. Those specials good through Tuesday at Brewers Outlet, the Beverage Supermarket, Reagan Street in Sunbury. Well, back in the fall of September 2016, leading up to the celebration and the 50th anniversary of Joe Paterno's first game as Penn State head coach, we had a golden opportunity to speak with a Penn State football legend, the one and only Mike Reed.
We're very pleased to have with us one of the true greats in the history of Penn State football, who has turned into one of the true greats in Nashville as well, Mike Reed. Mike, welcome to the show. It is great to have you with us.
Steve, wow, what a generous introduction. I can't thank you enough for that. I want you to tape that and send it to me so I can listen to it once a day.
Okay, that'd be great. My pleasure to do it.
No, it's a long time ago, those things, you know, so it's very, very kind and generous of you to mention those things.
It'll be 50 years Saturday, the first game was played, and John Runnels and Mike Irwin, they'll go out as the honorary co-captains for the game on Saturday. But in that game against Maryland, you are credited with 3 safeties in that game. What do you remember about that day?
Not a huge amount. I remember 2 things. I remember 2 of the safeties, Steve. I don't remember the third. The only thing I can figure, it must have been a... I know 2 of them were blocked punts, I think, and I don't really remember. The other thing was I remember dislocating, looking back on it now, dislocating 2 of my fingers on my right hand making a tackle. And I looked down at my hand, and my 2 fingers in the middle of my right hand were about an inch and a half long, and I thought, that doesn't look right, and I just instinctively grabbed them and pulled them back into, and taped them up and played the rest of the game. But the next day was as much pain as I can ever remember having. But, you know, I was a kid, and I was playing in those days. Steve, we had when we ran a 5-man front, I was a middle guard, and then a 4-man front, I was a middle linebacker. So I had two responsibilities. responsibilities there. But I don't remember. It's such an unbelievable 50 years this past.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember Joe, obviously. I remember Joe like I knew him like he was here yesterday, you know. He was a unique guy. I don't think any of us, maybe some of the guys you've talked to would differ with me, but I don't know that any of us had any inkling that we were involved in a ground floor of something that would grow to be pretty substantial. But you knew certainly, I remember as a kid, you knew certainly you were involved with somebody who was full of incredible passion. And I think the thing that separates great coaches like Joe from others is he had a vision in his head of what he wanted. He had a vision in his mind of what he wanted the program to be. And he was not going to stop until he turned the program into that. It was a long haul, you know. In those days, Steve, you know, Eastern football was not the most highly respected football. It was a loose kind of affiliation of Eastern teams. I think there was us, Boston College, Maryland, Pitt, Syracuse, West Virginia, right? Yeah. And they used to refer to it as the Big East, but I don't think there was an official conference, you know. And there wasn't really highly, and it was really Joe that really began to put Eastern football. And I might add, as a guy, you might not be old enough, Steve, to remember the name Ben Schwartzwalder. He was the coach at Syracuse.
Oh, Syracuse coach, yes.
Legend at Syracuse. Coached guys like Floyd Little, and Ben might even have coached Jim Brown, I'm not sure.
Coached Jim Brown, Larry Zonka,
yeah, and so those guys were the guys that put Eastern football on the map, you know, in those days.
Did you have a sense? You were recruited by Rip, correct?
Well, actually, yeah, from Rip's gang there, and there was a guy I met Rip, you know, I'm sure a few times, but there was a guy named Sever Turetti. He was gone.
Oh, yes.
Sever is a wonderful guy. Gregarious, charismatic Italian charmer. Boy, he could charm. I mean, he charmed my mother right off her feet. That was incredible. And my dad as well. And he was the guy that would come to Altoona and knocked on our door and talk to me. So, because it was my sophomore year, you know, these 50 years, my sophomore year was Joe's first year as head. And I think it was Rip before then. And Joe, am I right about this, that Joe was an assistant, like, what, 17 years?
Before he took over as head coach. And Sever Turetti, I had the privilege of knowing him for many years. It was exactly right. And I learned a lot just talking to him. I want to ask you about Joe early on. Did you get the sense that in the first couple of years, I know you had to redshirt one of them, but in the first couple of years that he was driven to prove that he could be a head coach?
That probably would have been something, Steve, I would guess that's private in his mind. It was something that was specific to his mind. I don't think Joe, look, I won't, even after five decades, I won't say that I knew Joe that well. He was an unsentimental guy, not a sentimental guy. To us, anyway, you know. Although you know that it was important, I'm sure that I'm not the first one to tell you this. He really cared about his players in the sense that he did not want us to come to Penn State to have just a football experience. He wanted us to have a college experience, and so he was. And I assume it stayed this way, but there certainly was no athletic dorm. I mean, we ate in the football season. We ate one meal together, the evening meal. We could go up to the hub and eat together. But it was vital to Joe that we have a university, that we have a college experience, not just a football experience. So in that sense, he really cared. He loved his players to be part of the on campus, to be part of the college. You know, I eventually, after a couple of stumbles, ended up majoring in music, and Joe loved that. He loved it. One of his players was wandering around the music halls, you know. he just got a kick out of that. So he cared in that sense, you know. He certainly cared in that sense. But, Steve, it would have been not like Joe to reveal revealed to his players that he was trying to prove that he deserved to be a head coach. I don't think there was any doubt. Look, he was a skinny little Italian guy that any one of Steve Smear or any of us could have grabbed by the throat, and that'd have been the end of that. But I lived in fear of that man, and I lived in fear of disappointing him from the very first time I met him. I think that's another quality, you know. I just did not want to, and I would go to the ends of the earth, whether it was working out in the off season, make sure I came into camp in shape or whatever, but I just did not want to disappoint that guy.
Mike, where did the love of music enter your life?
Very, very early on. My brothers and I grew up next to my grandmother on my dad's side, Grandma Granny Reed, and she had an old upright piano on her sun porch. Half the keys didn't even work, but my earliest memory, Steve, would be sitting on that bench, probably 3 or 4, banging on the keys. I don't remember anything other than that. And then when I was very young, I requested piano lessons, and it makes no sense to me. My folks were working blue collar workers, you know, mom and dad. Dad worked for the railroad, mom worked downtown at Kenny's Shoe Company. And so, I don't know. I think I remember the first music I was conscious of hearing were the hymns in church. They were the first music that really got my attention. So I don't know. I've never understood it that much. That clearly, Steve, it just knew it was there. And it's, you know, my love of athletics when I was a kid, as it will wane, you know, the older you get. But the love of music and writing has only intensified throughout the arc of my life. So, but explaining it or understanding it has eluded me. I don't know.
Yeah. Mike, I have to bring up this story because in getting ready for the broadcast we'll have to do on Saturday, Jack Ham gave me a call yesterday, and I mentioned that you were going to be on the show. And he says, you won't believe this. He said, one time I had, after the Pittsburgh Symphony played, Manny Axe was at my house. And I was talking to him about music, and he was trying to talk to me about linebacking. And I mentioned it to Mike Reed later, and Mike couldn't believe that we attempted to talk.
Manny Axe is a world-renowned pianist. I've seen Manny Axe play several concertos, and he's a serious world-renowned great pianist. And the thought that he was hosted by Jack Ham, I said, I don't know, that's either, I said to Hammer, I said, what is it? The earth is about to tilt off its axis, all right? I did ask him, of course, Hammer is one of them. You know, people always say to me, they want to know, when they know I went to college with Jack and our careers at Pittsburgh and Cincinnati intersected for a few years, Jack, they view Jack as they do Jack Lambert or a Dick Butkus, as this terror, this guy that eats small children, you know. And I always tell them, I say, you wouldn't believe if you met Jack Ham. You wouldn't guess that that's the Jack Ham, the legendary linebacker of the Steelers, because he's one of the funniest, kindest, sweetest guys that I know. Although Hammer and I have fallen out of touch, you know, over the years. But recently, you know, this event, we've been on the phone, and I am absolutely delighted to report that he has not lost one iota of his sense of humor. He's still the funny guy he always was.
Well, we're in our 17th season together, and everything you described, that's exactly who he is. So
Hammer is just Hammer, man. He's just he's a legend, but he's very uncomfortable with that. Or at least, in case he's listening, I will accuse him of pretending to be uncomfortable with that. He probably loves that. But I love the idea of Jack Ham, of Manny Axe wandering around Jack Ham's house. And
look, this is, first of all, the only sports talk show in America where Manny Axe actually has been mentioned in decades.
I got to tell you a funny story very quickly, if you have time. I was mentioned. I did an article years and years and years ago. I met the great legendary songwriter Randy Newman, there was a guy who did an article, a little sidebar piece involving me, and I mentioned Randy Newman, having met Randy Newman. And he mentioned that in this article, and later on in Rolling Stone, Randy Newman was interviewed. And they said, Randy, you know, what? Ask him something about things that excited him. He said, well, I just had recently one of the best things ever happened to me. Guy said, what? He said, I was mentioned in Sports Illustrated by this guy, Mike Reed. So those worlds, very funny. Very funny. He said, Newman said, man, there's no way. How am I going to get in Sports Illustrated? So that's the way that went.
That's great. Yeah. One final question, Mike, then I'll let you go. And it's a standard question I pretty much asked everybody, that in the 50s, when Joe made the decision, you know what, I'm going to stay in coaching and I'm going to try and make this as my profession, he had to call his father. His father, Angelo, after hesitating and hearing that he was not going to go into law, he was going to stake as a coach, said to him, well, if you're going to do that, make an impact. In the end, between Penn State and Joe Paterno, what impact did it have on Mike Reed's life?
Boy, that's a biggie. That's really a biggie. I think it's important too to keep in mind, Steve, that think of the age we were when we encounter Joe, the age any kid is when he encounters somebody like Joe. You know, it takes the human brain a full 25 or 26 years to develop. So there's, and the last part of the brain to develop is the part that is capable of making critical decisions. So you got parents delivering their kids into the hands of a guy like Joe Paterno long before the kids even have any idea. I used to say to my son, what were you thinking? Well, that part of his brain wasn't there, so he wasn't, you know. And when you parents were entrusting their kids to Joe Paterno at that age, you just were encountering, you know, someone who it was important to him that you do things the right way. He believed in organizational principles. He believed in a certain level of discipline. It wasn't abusive in any way, shape, or form. He knew what players he had to push and what he had to coax, which ones he had to coax. And he knew Stevie knew I was a kid that by yelling and screaming at me, you wouldn't get much out of me. But if you encouraged, right, I would go into the walk through the fire. So it's really, really very, very difficult. I mean, there are an awful lot of cliches we can use. You know, they can, I've said this before, I mean, statues can be taken down and games that were played and won can be declared non-existent if you really believe you can alter reality, for God's sake. But the effect that a man like that has on young, impressionable minds, and not just the thousands that played under him, but the thousands of more students that came to Penn State simply because they wanted to be where he was. They want to be around a man that, you know, people like are encouraged by greatness. And when you were encouraged by somebody like Joe, it made you just a little better than you thought you could be. So there isn't any one sort of, I really want to resist the cliche and just say I know this has been a very tricky, very, very challenging time for the school, the family, and I won't get into that. I know there's a long road to go yet out of that darkness, but you can't throw the baby out with the bathwater, for Pete's sake. This man did a huge amount of things for that university and for the kids who went to school and played for him, and that cannot be forgotten. That must not be forgotten.